So she is
Blog Talk Radio.
So, good evening to everybody. Now we got our Facebook Live audience, we got our friends with the Vibe Radio Network, and we are all getting all settled in to chat up some haunted colleges and universities. As we know, it's that time of year when people usually go back to school.
Not started school, but it's usually the first couple of weekends by now.
Yeah, this year's a little odd. This year's a lot odd.
Yeah. So we have the can with the cozy, and you know we're thoroughly going flash back to college days. I even made half puff cookies from my college.
Yes. So
puff cookies.
A classic college treat from St. Lawrence University. So we'll get into those in just a little. Put some in unless you want to dive in right now.
Not yet.
Okay. But yeah, so we're very happy to have everybody here tonight.
Yes. So we're going to talk about haunted universities and colleges. We did not put any Virginia ones on here, so I'm going to go ahead and set out there right now. A year ago, we actually did a Vibe Network show of all Virginia schools, and so this time we decided to expand out nationally and internationally with our stories, and we're actually going to start with Kristen's and my alma maters.
Yes.
So my alma mater is St. Lawrence University in upstate New York in Canton, New York. And it actually got visited by Ed and Lorraine Warren. When they were doing their college tours, they actually came by and they did several lectures, and they also did an investigation while they were there, so I was able to find that story, and we're going to share it with you tonight. Question, Marty?
Nope.
Okay.
We're good.
I always like to check before anybody dives into the story. All right. So St. Lawrence is a non-denominational private fine arts education and liberal arts education facility today. But it was founded in 1857 by the leaders of the Universalist Church. They were looking to establish a seminary west of New England and were enthusiastically actually courted by the citizens of Canton. The denomination was part of the liberal wing of Protestantism, and they were championing ideas as critical thinking, gender equality, and this all attributes to what has become the Theological School of St. Lawrence. It was progressive in teaching philosophy and co-educational from the beginning. The university exists as a preparatory department to provide a foundation for theological study. That department has become the liberal arts university today. The seminary closed in 1965, and with the consolidation of the period of the universalist denominations of Christianity. Now, the graduate program of education came in during the early 20th century, and this has now served hundreds of thousands of North Country school teachers and administrators, especially where I got my graduate education as well. During the period of the Great Depression and World War II, they did shut down the Brooklyn Law School, and that actually increased St. Lawrence's population at that point in time and grew it to be what we know it as today. It's a four-campus building with about 300 students in the 1940s became a 30-campus building with over 2,000 students within the next 25 years. The expansion actually came because we acquired another campus, a SUNY campus, when they decided to move to a different facility. We acquired a lot of their buildings, and that just made it so much easier to expand into, and several of those buildings are haunted as well. I actually developed an entire haunted ghost tour of my campus while I was living there, and it's still does today on one menu, which I'm very proud of. So we're only talking about one of the buildings. In 1947, two of the earliest campus buildings, which is Richardson Hall, that was built in 1855, and Herring Cole Hall, which was built in 1869, were listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In 1984, structures that were built before 1930 were listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it named St. Lawrence part of an old campus historic district.
You got an old, pretty university.
I do. It's a very old, pretty university. So, as I said, there are a number of hauntings on the campus, so we're going to focus on the team house that's known as the Hub. This drew the attention of paranormal investigator team Ed and Lorraine Warren, as I mentioned before. They did speaking tours at college campuses, and one of their stops in January 9th of 1979, including St. Lawrence University. Ed Warren, who is a demonologist, and Lorraine Warren, who is a clairvoyant, were scheduled for a two-day event that included a lecture and the case, the cases that they had investigated, including the Amityville Horror House. They also were going to walk through the residence at 1 Lincoln Street to determine who, if anyone, was haunting the storied room, or dorm, excuse me. The residence at 1 Lincoln Street was built in 1861 for Dr. John Stebbins Lee, who was the principal of the preparatory department at the early St. Lawrence University. Many actually refer to him as the original president of the university, but that's because most of the obituaries when he passed away actually refer to him as that. Dr. Lee's wife, Bennett, were extremely well regarded in Canton and elsewhere as within the community and the university. They had 5 children. They all went on to find very, very successful careers as college presidents, as scholars, as professors, and as educators. Dr. Lee lived out his days in the home. He passed away there in September of 1902. Emily went on to live with her daughter, Florence. Florence actually married a Whitman, and they moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she, her mother passed away 6 months after she moved in with her daughter. Emily did actually return to Canton for the funeral services, and she was laid out in that dormitory and then buried in the local Evergreen Cemetery next to her husband. After the Lees lived in the house, Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity actually occupied the house before they sold it in 1924 to J.H. Powers. He and his family lived in the house until 1928. And they faced financial difficulties at that point in time and had to sell it, and that's when St. Lawrence University actually acquired the property. At that point in time, Gamma Sigma Rho fraternity moved in, and it had been a fraternity for several seven years after that. The last fraternity to live in there was Phi Kappa Sigma, and it became the Huff House that it is today in 2006. St. Lawrence is a mixture of fraternity, sorority, and teen houses for people to live in, and I lived in one myself. Now, the Hub is a technology-orientated theme house where students who absolutely love technology, gaming, they have passion for computers. They basically love the core technologies of our society. They live together, they network, and they offer programs to the students at large. Every theme house is required to offer at least a program every quarter. And so usually 4, sometimes 6, depending on the theme house and how big it is. Now, in this building, there is a female apparition that has been seen by students who have lived on the property ever since the first fraternity was in there. They report feeling the presence of this unseen entity and experiencing other paranormal occurrences, such as hearing disembodied voices, footsteps, and empty parts of the building. The female figure is seen dashing around corners, wearing a long gown and possibly a red petticoat. The ghost appears to dislike rock and roll music, according to the former fraternity brothers who lived on property, and she would open the doors of rooms where the music was coming from. Despite many who claim to have countered the ghost over the years, the reason for her presence was unknown. Enter the Warren. So they came, as I said, in 1979, and they were accompanied by several students plus journalists. Lorraine immediately sensed the female spirit in the building, and she came face-to-face to it near a hallway radiator on the first floor. Several other members of the party saw her as well and gasped, "Oh, my God, there she is." Now, Lorraine actually saw the spirit as a middle-aged woman with her hair tightly pulled back, wearing an apron over a long plain dress. According to Warren, she was repeatedly placing an object in a cabinet in the butler's pantry. This is Warren's address. Stress that the house is very peaceful, the spirit is not a threat by any means. Now, as to who the ghost of the Hub is, we're not really sure. She wasn't able to get a name from the spirit or get a sense of who she was from the spirit. Some believe that it might be Dr. Lee's wife, Emily, or one of their 4 daughters. Florence often comes up as being a possibility for her. In addition, however, to Lee, they had 3 female servants who lived in property with them, and it might be one of those if you're considering it's a woman who's repeatedly putting something up in a butler's pantry and wearing an apron, first thing you're going to think of is it's possibly the housekeeper. So the housekeeper was Martha Farrell. She was middle-aged. Another possibility is Nora McCarter. She was a young domestic servant from Ireland. And the third possibility is Harriet Packard. She was the 11-year-old daughter on the site for the wheelwright who lived on property. My guess would probably be it's probably Martha, who's the housekeeper, middle-aged.
She makes sense, putting the stuff back in the pantry.
Yeah. But she seems to be what we term a movie with ghost or a stone theory ghost, somebody who's continually doing what they did when they were living there, and it's stuck or it's imprinted onto the building.
Mm-hmm. One of the many spirits that you have there over at St. Lawrence.
Oh, yeah, as I mentioned, I didn't have a ghost tour. So, mm-hmm. We only chose one because we wanted to stay chairs in school as we could.
Yeah, we got a lot tonight.
Yeah. So, Chris is going to pop over to Cox Sandwiches 10 miles away from Canton. And there are actually two universities in both of these towns. There's a SUNY in each town, and then there's St. Lawrence in mine and Clarkson in Clarkson.
Yeah. SUNY State University of New York.
Yes.
Want a cookie?
I do want a cookie.
Here's your
now
cookie.
Now that I've talked.
Now that you've talked, here's your cookie.
I get a cookie.
You get a cookie.
Can I have an apple?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to start with State University of New York in Potsdam. And it originally started as a teacher's college at Potsdam, and it's one of the oldest universities actually in the United States because it was established all the way back in 1916. Now, in the early 1950s, buildings started to spring up on the present site of where SUNY Potsdam is today after the state teacher's college joined the SUNY University system. Federally Hall was one of the first buildings opened in 1954 as the Benjamin Raymond Hall. Is one of the most recognizable buildings in town with its landmark clock tower as you drive through town on Route 56. In 1973, the building was renamed for O. Ward Satterley, the college's former director of education and the first dean of education, who died of a heart attack while sitting at his desk in the building in April 3, 1970. When the building first opened, the impressive college theater house offered state-of-the-art equipment and seated up to 800 people. The original theater, along with a smaller black box theater and office, are housed in the hall today. Due to the death of Dr. Satterley in the building, many believe Satterley Hall is be haunted by the spirit of Potsdam's first dean. Dr. Satterley's apparition is most often seen by students on the building's third floor, and it is said that he is sometimes even turns the clock tower light on at night. There is also activity in the theater's costume closet. Shadow Chasers, a local paranormal team, was brought in to investigate the many happenings in the costume closet. They brought their array of high-tech equipment and set it up to record. Phil Crichton, one of the co-founders of the team, reported that after they placed the equipment in the closet, they retreated back to the end of the hall, blocking all other access to the closet. When they went to retrieve the recorder later, Phil set foot in the room and walked into what he described as a high-energy field, or what might even be a ghost. As he backed out of the room with the recorder, one of his team members remarked, "You look like you fell out of the room, like you were hit." Phil instructed the others to set foot in the room and pointed to the doorway. They all tried walking through the door, called out, "Whoa," and each one of them came staggering back out. Phil decided to play the recorder back that had been recording the entire time. About halfway through the track, they heard a dog bark. They were all stunned as they no dog was present in the building and one had not even been heard in person. After reviewing the tape three more times, they all agreed that the EVP that they had caught was that of a barking dog, a small dog's yelps, as a matter of fact, something like a rat terrier. This was completely unexpected, as the stories for the costume closet often revolve around a female apparition seen in the room. 1 month later, the team investigated the costume closet again. The same dog barks were heard not once this time, but five times in one recording. The EVP was the clearest Phil had ever heard. It validated one student's story that had come to light since the first investigation. The student reported having to leave that room after attempting to retrieve something off of a shelf. She was alarmed by the sound of a barking from an invisible little dog. Phil researched and found no record of a dog dying in the hall. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but there is simply no record of it. It is possible that an actor left the dog sequestered in the room during performances in a makeshift kennel, and thus it has become protective of the space and guards the room to this day.
Now, Chris and I actually used to live near Satterley Hall, and I've actually been into Satterley Hall to get some theatrical equipment out of there when I was designing lights for one of the local high schools, and I had to walk past this closet, one more room to get to where the lights are, and that room has a very, very weird energy about it. You could feel it out in the hallway. You didn't even have to step into it.
Very oddly.
It is very off-putting.
Very spooky.
But that's not that room.
No, it's not. No, it's not. No, that's not the Clarkson building.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which actually is not really featured in here. Just long story short, moving on to Clarkson University, my alma mater, it's not a ghost story per se, but of the professors that have been at Clarkson over the years, one of them was Mr. Wes Craven himself of Nightmare on Elm Street fame. It's said that the very famous boiler room scene from the Nightmare on Elm Street movie was modeled after the basement of one of Clarkson's buildings there. So if you have seen that boiler room scene and, you know.
That was his university.
Yep. My university, well, it has its years on it, is a very respectable university.
Yeah.
It's not quite as gorgeous as yours is.
We are a liberal arts school.
Technical school here. But yeah, anyway, so Clarkson University. Now, it was founded in the wake of tragic circumstances, but its story starts with a family that was notable through the 1800s in New York State. The Clarkson family achieved notable wealth via stock and real estate investments, but the sons of the family were all expected to learn a trade. Thomas S. Clarkson, born in 1837, initially learned to operate a family farm, but in time grew his skills and holdings to include power plant development and large sandstone quarries along the Racket River in New York's North Country. Thomas and his wider family's commitment to the North Country and the town of Potsdam in particular were further exemplified by their founding of the Potsdam Public Library and Reading Room and a tuition-free night school that taught mechanical drawing. Thomas Clarkson's endeavors were brought to an abrupt end in 1894 when he was mortally wounded in a quarry accident. One of the workers was at risk of being crushed by a loose piece of equipment, but Thomas pushed the man clear and was subsequently struck by the equipment himself. Thomas passed away 5 days later. To honor their brother, Thomas's three sisters founded the Thomas S. Clarkson Memorial School of Technology in 1896. While the school has changed names a few times since its founding, Thomas S. Clarkson and his family are still well remembered as part of the history of Clarkson University and the town of Potsdam. Today, Clarkson's Office of Admissions and Welcome Center is housed in Holcroft House. Holcroft House, or the mansion as it was known when it was built in 1822 by John Carlton Clarkson, he lived there until 1835 when he returned to New York City. Lavinius Clarkson arrived to live in Holcroft House in 1840, and he passed away in the home in 1845. In 1852 or 1853, Keith Strakefield Clarkson and his wife, Anne Mary, moved to Holcroft to raise two daughters, Annie and Emily, and they lived there the rest of their lives. Annie inherited the property upon the death of her father in 1902 and was the last Clarkson to live there, often only using the house as a summer residence when she otherwise lived in New York City. Despite changing hands many times within the family, Miss Annie donated the entire Clarkson estate of 6,000 acres to Clarkson University in 1926, including Holcroft House. Holcroft House served as a men's dorm for Clarkson from 1939 through 1950 and then became the women's dorm through the 1960s and 1970s. Its use for the school shifted several times through the years before becoming the home of admission, and it has collected a fair number of haunted tales over the years of use. The first stories of the paranormal began to surface when the house was used as the women's dorm. The most prominent spirit is called Elizabeth, a name that was spelled out during a session with a Ouija board. But anyway, she appears mostly on the third floor, which during the time of the Clarkson's residence would have been a floor relegated to the servants. Many Clarkson heirlooms are stored and exhibited in Holcroft today.
it's possible that Elizabeth has an attachment to one of these artifacts. There are no records of any servants named Elizabeth, but Anne Mary's mother was named Elizabeth, and she was also Thomas's mother. It is possible that Elizabeth Clarkson is a resident ghost, as she did live briefly in the house during the 1870s with Anne Mary, and the university was established in memory of her son. Many believe it is appropriate for the mother of the university's namesake to now be welcoming students to Clarkson today. Elizabeth is described as a young woman in her late 20s, wearing a long dark skirt or dress and a blouse with sleeves that were puffy on the upper arm and buttoned snugly down around the forearm. She had dark hair pulled off her face and appears sad or tired. One graduate had an encounter in the early 1970s in her dorm room. She looked up to see a young woman standing at the foot of her bed and looking at her. She explained that she was surprised that the other residents of the house took so lightly to the experience. Apparently, sightings had become so frequent that many of the young women had grown accustomed to encountering the spirit. Over the years in the house, in addition to the aforementioned apparitions and Ouija board experiences, witnesses had lights come on by themselves, heard unexplained footsteps, experienced moving furniture, heard a woman crying, seen curtains parting by themselves, and heard banging sounds. Office equipment like the copier and calculators will operate unassisted, and unexplained banging will occur during office hours. In 1999, the year I entered the university, dating myself a little bit, the door to the third floor, which is always unlocked, was discovered inexplicably locked one day. That would generally not be a big deal, but some things had been very active at that time, and it made the employees wonder. Around that same time, bookends moved off a shelf as a mother and son were being interviewed in admissions. They watched in astonishment as something lifted the bookends and placed them on another surface. In the 1990s, a group of painters reported that they refused to work in the building at night as they felt a little too welcomed by the resident spirit. While in the house, they claimed that they had just walked away after cleaning their brushes in a sink when the faucet turned itself back on. The lights would also flicker frequently as they worked, but maintenance was unable to find any issues with the building's wiring. When they had had enough of the creepy experiences and decided to leave, their perfectly serviceable vehicle wouldn't turn on. This happened several times, and they believed that the ghost did not want them to leave the property. Stacy Tarbox was very familiar with Hallcroft House. It was her father was a night security guard for the property, and during the summer months, she and her sisters would go with him on his shift. They were curious about the ghost and stated the house never disappointed them. They saw shadow people, heard doors slamming shut on the third floor, saw an apparition of a woman in the window, and heard her crying. After her father retired, no one wanted to take that position because of the many things going on in the third floor offices. In 1987, the officials at Clarkson stated in a Times article that ghosts have no place in the halls of higher education. However, someone there may develop a means to detect and prove scientifically that ghosts exist. They certainly have one presence willing to make herself known in Holcroft House, and that's just one of the hauntings at the university today. They can say it's not haunted all they want.
We know otherwise. So if anybody's interested in reading more about our universities, there are actually in a couple of sets of books called Haunted Northern New York. There's four of them in the series. And I think between our universities, we're in at least three of them, and there's at least three stories each. So there's several, as I mentioned, places on this campus, plus the SUNY stories as well. Definitely worth checking out. They're, you know, smaller books, but they're a fun read. And part of our research library.
What is it in our research library? Don't ask.
Because I have not bought all the ghost books in the world.
No, you haven't.
Have my cookie.
That's
a good. Is it close to the pub cookie?
You know better than I would.
It's close.
Okay.
Not fully there, but it's close.
Good.
All right, so we're going to jump down to Pennsylvania and go to Gettysburg College.
I don't know what's going on.
I don't
know
either.
Sorry.
That's annoying. Anyway, their keyboard is stuck up on the middle burner. It's very annoying.
Silly.
Anyway, Gettysburg College was regularly ranked one of the best liberal arts colleges in the nation. It sits next to Gettysburg Battlefield. It actually overlooks it on a lovely knoll above the battlefield. And of course, Gettysburg battlefield was one of the bloodiest, most brutal battles of the Civil War. They had as many as 8,000 men killed during the three-day battle, and total casualties reaching as high as 50,000. Gettysburg is claimed to be one of the most haunted places anywhere, and we can attest to that. It's one of our favorite places to run away for the weekend.
Yep. It's been a few years since we've been there, but
yep.
It is a good getaway.
It is an awesome getaway. And our friends at Transcend Paranormal, Twisted Paranormal and Haunted Nights actually just had an event up there. Yeah, they had it while we were uptown in New York.
Oh, okay.
That one.
I was going to say, they just got back from Texas.
So, they're actually spreading out and going other places, so definitely look up for some of those maybe in the future. All right, so it was built in 1832, over three decades before the battle. Penn Hall is the oldest building that is standing on campus and has an impressive number of ghost stories attached to it. The building was pressed into service as a hospital and a morgue amidst the fierce clashes at the height of the battle. In the years since, echoes of this tumultuous chapter of the building's history still reverberate through the building. One of the first reported encounters was on the evening in the mid-1960s. Two campus employees took the elevator down to the building's first floor, caught a receipt.
Okay.
He's a cookie caught in the throat. Anyway. However, it refused to stop, and it carried them right down to the basement. When the doors opened, the personnel were greeted by a macabre field of a hospital scene. Soldiers lay dead or close to death on the floor. Blood-sodden doctors struggled to cope with amid the chaos. And despite the fever's pitch that the scene suggested, the whole report scenario played out silently. The chilling replay has occurred on numerous occasions, and the haunting hospital has always been seen by various individuals over the various decades. Ghosts don't stay confined to Penn Hall either. Students have been visited in residence halls, including Stevens Hall and Hubbard Hall, and they've encountered the lost and wandering spirits of dead soldiers all around the campus and in excursions to the battlefield. Stevens Hall, which was built in 1911, was originally used as a prep school for girls who would then later enter college. It is notoriously the most haunted dormitory on campus, and the residents over the years have described eerie experiences. It is famous for the ghost named the New Boy. The legend goes that one freezing winter night, a few girls snuck an orphan into their room to help him stay warm. When a house mother unexpectedly came in, they shoved the orphan onto the third-story window ledge, and when they went back to let him in, he was nowhere to be seen. It's never clear what happened to him, but the apparition of his blue face is pressed against the window, as well as strange noises throughout the dorm that have horrified residents ever since. Other students have described paranormal encounters in their first-year dormitory, which is Hubbard Hall. One student who wished to remain anonymous recalled a background experience with his alarm clock. I was sound asleep one night in Hubbard Hall, and I woke up to my alarm clock going off beeping 12, even though I didn't set it. When I pulled the cord out of the wall, the clock didn't turn off. Another student, Gabby Gill, recalled a terrifying night visit that left her shaking to the core. I woke up one night and to a pressure on my chest, and I heard somebody dragging across the floor. I closed my eyes, and when I opened them again, every single item on me and my room desk had been thrown onto the floor. A little digging turned up to the fact that the anonymous student and Gabby had each lived in the same room in public during their freshman years. Not all the paranormal activity is, of course, contained to the campus building. Sophomore football player Danny Thompson had a troubling experience when he wasn't even aware of it until he saw the proof on tape. He recalled, my coaches pulled me off into their office and asked me how I was feeling in practice the day before. I told them I felt awful. My head was pounding. I couldn't see straight. My legs hurt. What they said next is something that I will never forget. That's because you had a ghost inside you, Danny. In practice, the film that was taken from the preceding day, Thompson is seen running with the football when, out of nowhere, a white, misty, circular image appears to fly out of his head and across the screen. Danny said, if I hadn't seen the film, I wouldn't have believed it. But I did feel exceptionally weird that day at practice, and if it wasn't the ghost of a man, then I have no idea what it could have been. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising considering the school was built on a place where so many people died. Great. interesting possession during football practice. I mean,
but, I mean, it's not just the buildings, it's the
entire
property, the grounds, everywhere, and then that whole town, that whole city.
Yeah. And they're not shy about the fact that they are haunted when you're considered to be in one of the most haunted cities in the U.S. Sometimes that can kind of scare students away. Others, it attracts other students.
Careful what you wish for, as we always say.
So we're going to jump up to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Yes, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Moravian College. Now, this is one that I wasn't too terribly familiar with myself, to be honest.
I wasn't either until I found it.
Which is really kind of weird because your extended family doesn't live too far from here.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
I heard of it because we drive by it, but that's all I knew.
When I was doing some research on the place, it seems like a really interesting campus, really interesting little town. I wouldn't mind, you know, maybe if we drive through that area sometime, stopping and have a look around. But, yeah, interesting place. So Moravian College claims to be the sixth oldest college in the United States and the first to educate women as well as Native Americans in their own language. The college traces its roots to the Bethlehem Female Seminary, which was founded all the way back in 1742. As the first boarding school for young women in the U.S. The seminary was created by Virginia Countess von Zinzendorf, the daughter of Count Nicholas Ludwig Zinzendorf, who was the benefactor of the fledgling Moravian communities in Nazareth and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
So if you didn't know, Pennsylvania had a lot of German immigrants.
A lot of them.
My family.
Yes. The female seminary was incorporated by the Pennsylvania State Legislature in 1863 and became the women's college, the Moravian Seminary and College for Women in 1913. The college also traces its roots to the founding of two boys' schools established in 1742 and 1743, which,
That's how cookies are talking.
In the air. But anyway. Which merged to become Nazareth Hall in 1759. Located in the town of Nazareth, Nazareth Hall became in part Moravian College and Theological Seminary in 1807. It was later incorporated by the Pennsylvania State Legislature as Moravian College and Theological Seminary in 1863 as a baccalaureate-granting institution. Beginning in 1858 and continuing to 1892, the seminary and college relocated from Nazareth to a former boys' school on Church Street in Bethlehem, located on the present site of the Bethlehem City Hall. The men's Moravian College and Theological Seminary then settled in the north end of the city, the present-day North Campus, as a result of a donation from the Bethlehem Congregation of the Moravian Church in 1888. The first buildings constructed at North Campus, Cummins Hall and Zinzendorf Hall, were completed in 1892 and joined to the property's original brick farmhouse to form the new campus. The farmhouse was later named Hamilton Hall, which still stands today. In 1954, the two schools combined to form the single coeducational modern institution of Moravian College. The merger of the two institutions combined the North Campus, the men's college location, and the South Campus, the location of the women's college, into a single collegiate campus. The distance between the North and South campuses is about 0.8 miles of Main Street called the Moravian Mile. First-year students traditionally walk the Moravian Mile as part of their orientation activity. Although the college is one of the oldest educational institutions in the United States, it is not considered one of the 9 original colonial colleges, but rather a colonial-era foundation. Moravian College and Theological Seminary, as well as the Bethlehem Female Seminary, did not start granting baccalaureate degrees until 1863. Tales of the paranormal are commonplace in Moravian College. One such tale takes place in Brethren's Hall, once a Revolutionary War makeshift hospital where more than 100 soldiers passed away. Students have reported many ghost sightings in the building, and those who visit Brethren House today for music and arts tell of seeing the apparition of a nurse who wanders the halls. In an article on Moravian's website, student Katie Bonick relays what happened when she took a non-believer to the house. The door at the top of the stairs clicked funny behind us. Because I had spent a great amount of time in this building, I knew that it's not what it should have sounded like. I brushed this off and we proceeded down the first floor hall. Not even a minute later, It was so loud in the building it almost sounded like a train went by. We couldn't hear one another speak. It sounded like there were carts rolling, almost 25 to 30 people running up and down the hallway above us. It was so loud that they looked at each other in terror and ran out the side door closest to the main hall. Stood outside for a few moments before they said, "What the heck was that?" Answer, what else? Ghostly nurses running up and down the hall and haunted gurneys rolling up and down the hallway. Maybe, maybe not.
Nightmare fuel.
Nightmare fuel. Yeah, that's something like a train rolling over your head. That's got to be pretty loud.
Yeah.
We have experience with that down in Chapel Mountain. Trains rolling by overhead. That's very loud.
That is extremely loud.
I have a hard time imagining that something like a hospital gurney that loud. In any case.
I can say, imagine the opening scene or the hospital scene in Return to Oz with the spooky ghost getting rolled by. That's what I picture.
Anyways, with over 250 years of history, Moravian College certainly has its fair share of history to have the haunted tales go with it.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to pop over to Vermont, and we're going to go to the University of Vermont in Burlington. Now, Burlington is Vermont's largest city, and it's the University of Vermont is the largest university in the state. It helps, perhaps, is the reason why maybe it's one of the most active hotspots for supernatural activity. And that a number of the ghosts within the halls of UVM may rival the headcount of the living student body. It is considered the most haunted college in Vermont. The following are some of the things that have been reported. In the agricultural department, the Caesar Suite House, it has a female ghost in dress period, circa the late 19th century. So late 1800s, she unexpectedly makes her appearance known. And the Center for the Cultural Pluralism, or the Allen House, has a ghost that is taking up residence on the top floor. Although he or she hasn't been seen visually, though chilling presence can be felt in the vicinity of her, makes them very uncomfortable. And the Center for the Counseling and Testing is rumored to be haunted. The former director of the center encountered the ghost of Captain Jacob, a retired seaman who died there in the early part of the 20th century. Poltergeist activity, which often is described as a noisy ghost activity, has been reported there as recently as 1992, and it seems that Captain Jacob is a restless spirit. The grassy moss house comes with a vibrant, though eerie history of ghostly voices, doors that slam and lock themselves without human effort. Converse Hall is recorded as haunted by a former student who committed suicide there. Although never seen, the student remains as active in death as he might have been when he was one of the living. He actually turns radios on and off and interacts with the various electrical equipment. He actually electrocuted himself in 1992.
That was suicide.
Yeah.
Electrocuting yourself.
Ouch.
That's a way to go. I guess, though, there's the... Well, it's kind of grim, but the stereotypical, the toaster in the bathtub.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. Coolidge Hall. This is a dormitory that has a few resident ghosts, including a male present that likes to awaken the residents by staring at them. Then there's a playful spirit who enjoys pulling the blankets off of beds and whistling specters that can't carry a tune. You certainly don't want to lose your blanket in the middle of the winter in Vermont.
I'm sorry, Anna.
Redstone Hall Dormitory, the residents include a ghost that appears at the back staircase and has been seen to run through the wall. He's not fond of female students and for some reason has chased frightened students out of the area on occasion. And in Simpson Hall, there's a spirit of a man who stalked a female student to her dorm one year, apparently, and never left. He now resides in the Simpson Hall today. Late at night, students wake up with a sensation of being watched. Usually the rooms become icy cold when it happens, and some students wake up freezing cold at night with the feeling that there is somebody else in their bed. Kind of glad I didn't accept the University of Vermont.
If you did, we wouldn't be here today.
No, we wouldn't.
It's funny how little things come together like that.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to come south and kind of hop down to Alabama.
Alabama.
We need to warm up after that freezing cold.
Montebello. Is it Montebello?
Montebello.
Montebello in Alabama. University of Montebello. the only public liberal arts college in Alabama, the University of Montebello has long been ranked as one of the top regional colleges in the South and one of the best colleges for veterans. Montebello was officially founded as a technical school for women in 1896, but its history goes back much further, with numerous buildings such as the King House and Reynolds Hall standing as some of the oldest in Alabama. And with old buildings, of course, comes old ghost stories. And truly, the University of Montebello is one of the most haunted colleges in all of America. Visitors can see the spooky sights on the annual Montebello Ghost Walk. Reynolds Hall is said to be haunted by the ghost of its namesake, Captain Henry Reynolds, who watches over the building out of guilt. In charge of protecting the building, which was being used as a hospital during the Civil War, Reynolds abandoned his post, drawn away by a Union attack at another location, only to return to find the hospital overrun and the patients taken prisoner. Also in residence is the ghost of Dr. William Trumbauer, who cheerfully annoys people in the theater at Palmer Hall, bitter that the building wasn't named after him. Montebello's two most famous ghosts are Edmund King, who built King House back in 1823, and the tragic ghost of Maine Hall. King, an old wealthy man at the start of the Civil War, supposedly buried his fortune in the fruit orchard behind his house to save it from Union troops, if they should ever take the town. Unfortunately for King, he died before the end of the war and still haunts the house and its grounds. At times, he wanders around the orchard with a shovel and lantern trying to remember where the gold is buried, while at other times he can be seen in his office brooding over his money. Sadly, the ghost of Maine Hall is said to be that of a student, Condy Cunningham, who accidentally died in 1909 when the alcohol stove which she was using to make hot chocolate spilled, catching her dress on fire. Residents in Maine Hall have been known to hear a woman screaming in the night and sometimes running down the hallway in flames. Kathy Lowe, director of Alabama School's Carmichael Library, told the Shelby County Reporter that women students have reported hearing screaming and moaning in the hall, and on the wooden door of her dorm room you could see Cunningham's face, eyes, nose, and mouth with flames. Lowe added that the door was later removed owing to the undue curiosity.
I don't know if I want to go visit this college.
Well, they took the door down. What are you going to go see now?
Oh, maybe go treasure hunting.
Go treasure hunting? Well, mm-hmm. Go treasure hunting in the orchard.
Yeah,
good one.
Oh,
okay. I'll keep on going. We're going to go on up to almost dead center middle of the country. We're going to go to good old Oklahoma. University of Oklahoma, which is in Norman, Oklahoma, just south of Oklahoma City. A lot of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
When you peruse the University of Oklahoma website, you might be surprised that among the more standard information about staff or academics, there's actually a link to the history of haunted Ellison Hall. Home to the College of Arts and Sciences, Ellison Hall is also home to a roving spirit, that of a young boy roaming hallways on his roller skates. In 2013, a medium investigating the spot said the boy was named Bobby. According to the school's website, Bobby was either hit by a car or had an asthma attack and died after being brought into Hygieia Hall, the school's infirmary. In later years, Hygieia Hall was renamed Ellison Hall, and with it, various reports of roller skates being heard gliding across the second and third floor hallways. Even the dean's staff has noted strange occurrences, including motion sensor lights going on and off and no one there, strange sounds coming from empty halls and vacant offices, and the sound of voices and dishes clinking on the first floor. These spooky incidents have prompted various media and paranormal investigators to check it out. Besides Bobby, there have been sightings of a nurse, a man, and maybe even Dr. Ellison himself, who ran the infirmary. Bumping on up to Chicago.
Roller skating ghosts, though.
Roller skating ghosts. I wonder how long ago it was. It's kind of in a very unique time frame. Obviously, it was long enough ago that the building had a previous name,
mm-hmm.
More recent enough so that there were roller skates and automobiles were very common.
It could be the 1940s and 50s where you actually had the pairs attached to your shoes.
It could be.
Those are not fun.
I've never tried
them.
I never tried them.
Yeah. I did.
probably a reason we don't see him anymore.
I hope
you go to an antique store. The whole antique store that we've been to, I don't think I've ever seen him.
I have.
Oh, I wasn't paying attention then. Or I just glanced right by. It happens. Anyways, up to Chicago, Illinois, we're going to go to Roosevelt University. Now,
this one is fascinating.
This is very interesting. So, Roosevelt University was founded in 1945. It's a fairly recent one. By Edward J. Sparling, the president of Central YMCA College in Chicago. He refused to provide Central YMCA College's board with the demographic data of the student body, fearing the board would develop a quota system to limit the number of African Americans, Jews, immigrants, and women at the school. Sparling resigned under protest and took with him many faculty and students to start a new college. Faculty voted in favor 62-1 and students 488-2 for the school. In the beginning, the university had no library, campus, or endowment. University in name only.
Yep.
Now, the new college was chartered as Thomas Jefferson College in March 28, 1945, and had financial backing from Marshall Field III, the Julius Rosenwald Foundation, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and numerous other individuals and organizations. 2 weeks later, President Franklin Roosevelt died. The college obtained his widow Eleanor's permission to rename the institution as Roosevelt College in his memory. In 1947, the college purchased the auditorium building for $1. It became the permanent home. The college was rededicated to both Franklin and Eleanor in 1959, and early advisory board members included Marian Anderson, who was a famous singer and activist for civil and human rights, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Pearl Buck, you might remember The Good Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I know I had to read it when I was back in school. Most people probably did.
Yeah.
Nobel Peace Prize recipient Ralph Bunche, Albert Einstein, who, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Physics, Nobel Prize for Literature recipient Thomas Mann, Nobel Prize for Economic Sciences recipient Gunder Myrdal, and here's a not a Nobel Prize winner, but advertising executive Draper Daniels. Now, if that somewhat kind of rings a bell, that's because Draper Daniels was the inspiration for Don Draper of the TV show Mad Men.
As you said, interesting university.
Oh, yeah, and actually one more Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Albert Schweitzer. So they had quite the backing behind them when they went ahead and got the show on the road. Now, fast forward to August of 1996, the university opened its Albert A. Robin campus in Schaumburg after a donation from Albert A. Robin, an entrepreneur and immigrant. On March 9th, 2020, Robert Morris University of Illinois merged with Roosevelt University, and the integrated university continued to operate under the Roosevelt University name. Robert Morris added its majors to Roosevelt's large portfolio of undergraduate and graduate programs under the name of Robert Morris Experimental College, or Experiential College, one of the several colleges at Roosevelt University. Now, back to the auditorium building. This is the one with the haunted history. It used to be connected to the Congress Plaza Hotel until 1911. The Congress Hotel is considered to be one of the most haunted places in all of Chicago. It makes sense that something may have followed Peacock Alley, an underground walkway, into the auditorium building. Both the Congress Hotel and auditorium building were built for the World's Exhibition in 1893, now known as the World's Fair, as hotels. However, the auditorium building had a theater made to rival the Met in New York City. Now, why are there so many ghosts in the auditorium building at Congress Plaza Hotel? Top two reasons for that, the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 and Native Americans. Right outside the main doors of Roosevelt University lies Michigan Avenue, a major roadway in downtown Chicago. Lake Michigan used to reach this street, but that changed after the fire. The city pushed the smoldering rubble into the lake, and that's what made most of the land for what is now Grant Park across the street, the street from Roosevelt University, and as well as the Streeterville neighborhood to the north. Essentially, the auditorium building was built next to a graveyard. There's bound to be a few spirits that will haunt their old neighborhood. Also, there's the curious case of a Native American battle with the U.S. military near the location. The Battle of Fort Dearborn occurred in 1812, long before the auditorium building, with more than 400 Powhatomi warriors attacked the fort and its regiment of 67 U.S. soldiers. The battle only lasted 15 minutes. The Powhatomi tribe successfully captured the fort, but they lost 15 warriors. The U.S. military lost 38 soldiers and 14 civilians. A little bloodshed in a swampy convergence of the Chicago River in Lake Michigan can imbue the ground with some ghostly essence. Aside from the violence and tragedy that took place at the site where the university stands today, since the inception of the Auditorium Theater, decades worth of energy filled with performances filled the building with all kinds of emotions. So what happened in the Auditorium Theater? Many witnesses would recall seeing phantoms sitting in the seats but subsequently vanishing when approached. In other cases, you can still hear the roar of applause from an approving audience when the theater is empty. The same goes with laughter and the low buzz of chit-chat. Witnesses have also been seen shadow people roaming the lonely aisles at night. There is a ghost that seems to love a dramatic entrance. It jumps from the catwalk 40 feet above the stage and vanishes right before it hits the floor. Poltergeist-like activity has also been experienced in the building's Academic Success Center at the south end of the Michigan Avenue lobby. Office workers have had their water bottles and coffee mugs thrown off of their desks by an unseen hand. In the basement on the Congress Parkway side of the building, guards have seen lockers slammed shut and heard running down the empty hallways. There is also a substantial amount of activity on the upper floors. Starting on the 8th floor and going up to the 10th and 11th floor libraries, witnesses have seen apparitions of maids, violinists, and seen objects moving on their own.
We need to go to Chicago.
Yeah, never been to Chicago. Just flown through there many a time.
And I went when I was little, so I don't remember much. All right, so we're going to continue going west. We're going to hop over to Colorado and the University of Denver. In March of 1864, John Evans, the former governor of Colorado Territory, founded the Colorado Seminary in the recently founded city of Denver. At its founding of the cemetery, it was non-sectarian and operated by the Methodist Episcopal Church. It struggled in the early years of its existence, but it persevered, and in 1880, it was renamed the University of Denver. Although it's doing business as the University of Denver, it's still legally named the Colorado Seminary. The first buildings of the university were located downtown in the 1860s and 1870s. The concerns that Denver's rough and tumble frontier town atmosphere was not conducive to education, that prompted a relocation to the current campus built on the donated land of a potato farmer, Rufus Clark. It is 7 miles south of the downtown core. The university grew and prospered alongside the city's growth, adhering primarily to the regional student body prior to World War II. After the war, the large surge in the GI Bill students pushed enrollment over 13,000 students and the largest university had ever seen. It helped to spread the university's reputation as a national audience. The heart of the campus has a number of historic buildings. The longest standing building is University Hall, which has served the campus since 1890. In classic Denver style, the cornerstone of this building is exactly 1 mile above sea level. Just a few blocks off campus is the historic Chamberlain Observatory, which was opened in 1894. It is still a fully functional and operational observatory today and is open to the public on scheduled days. Excuse me. Now, other buildings on the campus that contribute to some of this most chilling tale. The administrative offices are actually located in the Mary Reed Building, a former library built in 1932 in the collegiate Gothic style. Many have reported feeling cold spots in the rooms that are otherwise very warm, doors that will open one moment and then stick closed the next and abruptly open on their own. Then there's a specter of a woman who has been reported on numerous occasions. Marjorie Reed Hall, named for the daughter of Mary Reed, was also built in the collegiate Gothic style in 1929. Marjorie, a University of Denver alumni, died under suspicious circumstances in 1925 after a trip to Peru with her husband, whom she had met on campus. Some think that she was murdered by her husband for her money, but that was never proven beyond a doubt. In any case, her mother, Mary, donated the funds for the university to build the Marjorie Reed Hall. Could it be that it is haunted by her namesake? The art department's in this house. This house in this hall, and the performances that will play there are often heard weird echoes and whispers. There's a portrait of her that hangs in the building that is said to have eyes that follow your every move. Now that makes perfect sense if you were told by your husband.
Oh, me.
Author Phil Goldstein knows another building is the historic Bushell House and has been known to make its guests uncomfortable with chilly grass, some slamming of doors. He also explains that it might be Henry Bushell's spirit protesting the party serving of alcohol in his former home. He was the university's chancellor and the Colorado governor, who was also a militant prohibitionist.
Boom.
So he doesn't like the alcohol.
Cheers.
All right, we're going to bounce back this way and come back to Ohio.
So, Ohio University was first envisioned by Manasseh Cutler, credited as the school's founder, along with Revolutionary War Brigadier General Rufus Putnam. Cutler had served as a chaplain in Washington's Continental Army. The institution's name was American University. President Thomas Jefferson's policy initiatives included westward expansion of the new nation with the addition of several territories to U.S. statehood. In 1797, settlers from Marietta traveled downstream on the Ohio River and ended up on the Hocking River to establish a location for the school. Founding Athens due to its location directly between the original capital of Chillicothe and Marietta, in 1802, approval was granted by the territorial government for the establishment of the American Western University, but the school was not operated under that name. So, Ohio University was recognized by the new state on February 18, 1804, as its charter was certified by the Ohio General Assembly. The first three students enrolled in 1809, and the first two bachelor's degrees were granted in 1815. Ohio University is the oldest university in Ohio and the 8th oldest public university in the United States and the 30th oldest among public and private universities. It's got its age. It's up there a little bit. So now 218 years old, Ohio University is said to be harboring ghosts and ghouls. A mental hospital called the Athens Lunatic Asylum was built next to the university in 1874 and was in operation until 1993. In the early 1980s, a newspaper reporter reported that Wilson Hall was actually built over the hospital cemetery. Something straight out of the movie Poltergeist. Never seem to get that right.
No.
If that's not scary enough, the university is founded right in the center of a pentagram of burial grounds in the area. Some think that all these circumstances may open up the portals to haunting. When the asylum closed, all of the land and buildings were donated to Ohio University, including the main asylum building that was renovated into what is now known as the Ridges, a mixed-use campus facility. There is one remnant of the asylum's past that lingers on in a seldom-used portion on the top floor. In December of 1978, a patient named Margaret Schilling went missing and initially could not be found despite an exhaustive search. Over a month later, her decomposing body was found in a locked ward on the top floor, and her body left a stain on the floor that remains to this day. In addition to the physical mark that Margaret left behind, some attribute paranormal activity to her as well. After students started moving in, reports of disembodied screams, rattling door handles, and ghostly specters started to occur. Ohio University is also the only university with a room that's been permanently sealed off because of a ghostly sighting. Room 428 of Wilson Hall is notoriously haunted. Room 428 has been sealed off in the dorm in response to the many strange sounds, footsteps, and moving objects that have been reported by students over the years. Deemed uninhabitable by student or school officials, the history behind this off-limits dorm room is rather freaky. It was there that a student in the 1970s was reportedly possessed. She was acting strangely and spoke in strange languages before jumping to her death. Bless it, seal it away.
Never anything.
Somebody will forget about it one day and they'll open back up. Then we'll know for sure.
If we're alive.
Now, as we promised, this was also going to be an international show. So,
we're going across the pond.
Yes, we are. So we are going over to jolly old England.
Merry old England.
Merry old England.
And the University of Oxford, which I've been to, which is awesome. The University of Oxford is a collegiate research facility in Oxford, Oxfordshire, England. There's evidence of teaching as early as 1096, making it the oldest university in the English-speaking world and the world's second oldest university in continuous operation. It grew rapidly from 1167 when Henry II banned English students from attending the University of Paris. After the disputes between the students and the Oxford campus in 1209, some academics fled northeast to Cambridge, where they established what became the University of Cambridge. The two ancient English universities share many common features that are often jointly called Oxbridge.
Oxbridge.
Oxford is made up of 39 semi-autonomous constituent colleges, 6 permanent private halls, and a range of academic departments, which are organized in 4 divisions. All the colleges are self-governing institutions within the university, each controlling its own membership and within its own internal structure and activities. All students are members of a college. It does not have to be the main campus, and its buildings and facilities are scattered throughout the entire city center. It is a very large place to go in. Oxford operates the world's oldest university museum, as well as the largest university press in the world and the largest academic library system in Great Britain. Ghost number one, King Charles I. During the English Civil War, Oxford was home to King Charles I, a city where there was a royalist stronghold during much of the battle. With its strategic location and wealth from the colleges, it seemed an obvious place for him to reside. Whilst here, he turned the Christ Church College deanery into his palace and held sessions for the counter-parliament in his great hall. After 7 years of fighting between Charles's supporters and Oliver Cromwell's parliamentarians in the Civil War, Charles was eventually defeated and imprisoned in 1646 in Hampton Court Palace. When he finally was convicted of treason in 1649, he was given the death penalty and was executed outside the banqueting house in Whitehall. It is believed that Charles I rests his spirit in the city he loved, Oxford, more specifically at Christ Church College. However, there has also been noted sightings of him in the Bodleian Library. This is a rather fitting location, as whilst in Oxford, the king was denied leave to borrow books from the library in 1645. As an act of rebellion, people said he now torments the library, sometimes with and sometimes without his head, and has been seen running around the upper reading room at night, pulling books from the shelves and reading one line and placing them back and never ending the game. He seems to be quite a mischievous man. Then there's Colonel Francis Windang. It is believed the main library at Merton College is home to the ghost of Colonel Francis Windang, another royalist who was executed in 1645 during the English Civil War. Windang was a young and newly married colonel in the Royalist Army who was appointed governor of Balchington Park in Oxfordshire in 1645. In April of that year, he decided to host a ball at his estate to raise his wife's and his friend's spirits during the English Civil War. However, it's believed that a parliamentarian spy snuck in as during the ball and Balchington House came under attack by Oliver Cromwell's army. In a brave and noble stance to protect the lives of his wife and his friends, Windang immediately surrendered when troops arrived. He was later marched to King Charles's headquarters in Oxford, where his excuses were refused, and he was tried by a royalist court-martial for failing to protect Belgium Park from Cromwell. As punishment, he was then executed against the town wall, which was adjourned to Merton College, and his famous last words were said to have been, "God save the king." It is now believed that Windang haunts the site of his execution, known as Dead Man's Walk, and also the college library. Those who believe in his spirit believe he lingers due to feelings of injustice at being executed for what he considers to be an act of chivalry. Oh, it's so tragic.
Very tragic.
William Lobb, This is at St. John's College, still in Oxford. It is the home to the long distinguished ghost, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Waugh, who was a religious advisor to King Charles I during his residency in Oxford. Waugh, who was born in Oxford and now educated in St. John's College, spent much of his career devoting himself to imposing unity on the Church of England by implementing a series of reforms that persecuted and attacked Protestant practices of English Puritans. That was quite a literary illusion, I had. Not illusion. You know what I mean.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you.
My typing that.
Not fair to stick that at the end of the story. In 1644, during the midst of the Civil War, William Waugh was formally tried for popery, tyranny, and treason. Those charging him fought the case that Laud had been one of the key figures who was causing the conflict between the monarchy and the parliament, which eventually led to the English Civil War. On January 10th of 1645, Laud was then taken to the Tower of London, where he was beheaded. Laud's remains were then taken back to his home city of Oxford and buried under the altar of the chapel at St. John's College. Students today believe they have seen him in the college's library, where he has been known to pull his head from his neck and kick it along the floor. Why do I feel like I'm in Hogwarts? Seriously. Okay. I did not see all of these libraries. I kind of wish I had. Moving on to the Philippines.
Yes. Yeah. Now we're really going for a stretch. Really stretching our legs. Going to De La Salle University over in the Philippines. So De La Salle University, formerly known as De La Salle College, was established back in 1911. During World War II, the nearly 34-acre campus grounds were seized by the Japanese forces and converted into defense quarters. This part of the university's history may well be part of the reason why the university is rife with stories that spook its 20,000 undergraduate and postgraduate students and faculty.
Large school.
Yeah. So we got a whole bunch of kind of interesting personal stories from De La Salle, and we'll get to the... I think it was great that they tried to get rid of the Puritans who were and would continue to lead all of their witch hunts and witch trials. Headless ghosts like Harry Potter, yep.
Yep. As I said, I felt like we were in Hogwarts.
And what was it? The Headless Riders Club or something?
Yes. That poor Nick wanted to be part of.
Yeah. Nearly, but he was only nearly headless.
The dad's a headless.
Yes. I mean, back to De La Salle University. Now, as I said, a bunch of individual stories from students that have been there on the campus, starting with a woman by the name of Julia Villanueva of De La Salle University. She knew about her school's haunted history and about the people who lost their lives inside the campus during World War II, and numerous ghost stories it spawned decades after. Still, she never thought she herself would experience something eerie one night in school. She recalled, "I used to be part of the school orchestra. The day before a concert, we normally would rehearse and would go on late until the night. Lucky if we finished by 11 p.m. One late night after practice, when everyone was packing up, all of a sudden the lights went off, then boom, someone slammed shut the two main entrance doors in the hall, creating a thunderous sound. Here's the scary part. In the blink of an eye, all the lights were on and the doors were no longer closed. Everything was back to normal as if nothing had ever happened, yet everyone in the room witnessed the entire incident. We could have sworn that someone or something was making its presence felt." That's kind of creepy. Moving on, we got Edith. That was Yuna. She's okay.
Oh. I can't wait till we can let her out again.
Edith Kajian, who had bandmates talented enough to shine like stars in the industry. They would often spend their free time in the music room, and during these off hours, they would sometimes have some interesting experiences. She recalled, "Whenever we're at the music room in the School of Design and Art campus, we would sometimes feel like there are others beside us. We would often stay in the music room between 6 and 9 p.m. or arrive early around 6 a.m. This is usually when the weird stuff started happening. Once, when I was playing my piece, the pages of my note sheet turned by themselves, which is impossible because the room didn't have any windows. It completely freaked her out. She added, but I'm glad it kept calm and carried on. After a while, it just felt like I had a bandmate that I just couldn't see.
This is helpful.
Yeah, she's very helpful, very comfortable with the spooky presences. Then we got Jason Nuela and his buddies. They were a fun-loving bunch of misfits who thought of doing a mischievous deed during a rare overnight activity on campus. It was one incident they'll never forget, and for all the wrong reason. He recalled, back in school, we've always been told that the corridors and rooms of our beloved alma mater were haunted, but we never really encountered anything paranormal until the night we decided to take matters into our own hands. On the day of their Bouviac, an activity where students camp overnight in school, he and his friends decided to sneak out and go ghost hunting. Jason continued, being kids, we were very excited, yet skeptical of the ghost stories we've heard. But as we climbed the stairs of one of the buildings, our noisy chatter turned into nervous whispers. The place got more eerie with every floor we passed. Once they reached the fourth floor, the last floor of the building, Jason said he spotted something unusual, a faint light. He said, I couldn't believe my eyes, so I asked my friends to turn off their flashlights and cell phones, thinking it was just their devices that the source of light was coming from. But the faint light started getting larger and more vivid, as if it was coming towards us. Before I knew it, the light looked like it was just a few steps away from me, and it got even closer. The light appeared to be flickering like a candle. Then I realized what it was. A person was holding a candle and coming towards me. When I figured out what I was seeing, I ran for my life. I was so frightened, I screamed and rushed down the stairs out of the building. One of my teachers saw me running and demanded to know why I was not in the Bouviac. I was still too scared to even acknowledge his presence. I just kept running until I got back to my tent and waited for my friends to arrive. To this day, Jason cannot forget the spine-tingling incident. He said, it still boggles me. Not long afterward, I heard a rumor about a kid who allegedly committed suicide on that very corridor. I've also been told that the spirit of monks haunts the halls of our school. Whatever it was, I don't want to know. So I've got a few comments here. Let me see what I got. Nearly headless. Oh, what better ghost? No, it was just a fuzzy murder muffin, yes.
Yes, she decided to try to bat at something from her hammock, and
she took a minor little tumble, which...
We're trying for the stitches.
Yeah.
That's why she's in here.
Well, let's see. Glenn says, difference of my high school, I went, the teacher was murdered during summer school class. She was reported to be seen on the staircase and heard walking the hall. There are EVPs of her humming, and the orb is spotted where she was killed. Happened in Maryland at my high school. She was stabbed to death and found in the bathroom.
Ooh.
Oof. And she still haunts the place to this day.
I got to say, I would not return to the high school I was teaching at if I needed to haunt him, or I would be haunting one of our short locations.
Just that.
Yeah. Well, contractually obligated to haunt our two locations when we got.
Yep.
Just so everybody knows.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and Patrick, maybe you missed the first few minutes, but Una had her...
her things.
Yep. Some little bits removed.
Yep.
So she's healing up from that. She's perfectly healthy. She's just got to let those stitches heal. And in the meantime, she's very restless.
Yeah, she's not pleased being in the kennel this long. But she gets a sister on Wednesday.
Yes.
So we're going to have a new kitten to introduce on our next show.
And Una will be, of course, free to roam again at that point. So.
She will. She keeps trying to push her way out of the kennel. All right, so our last one is the University of Toronto up in Canada. The founding of a colonial college has been the desire of John Graves Simcoe. Now, some of you may be familiar with that if you are a revolutionary, but this is the same Simcoe who came to Virginia, who came to Richmond with Benedict Arnold, and helped participate in the burning of this city during the Revolutionary War. Yeah, that Simcoe.
Yeah.
Now, he was the first lieutenant of Upper Canada. He was an Oxford-educated military commander who had fought in the American Revolution, and he believed that college was needed to counter the spread of republicanism from the United States. The Upper Canada executive community recommended that in 1798, a college be established in York and the colonial capital. In March 15 of 1827, a royal charter firmly issued by King George IV proclaiming from this time one college with the style and privileges of a university for the education of youth and principles in the Christian religion and for their instruction in various branches of science and literature to continue forever and be called King's College. The granting of the charter was largely a result of intense lobbying by John Strassman, influential Anglican Bishop of Toronto, who took office as the college's first president. The original three-story Greek Revival school building was built on the present site of Queen's Park. And you can see the mountain of it. Now, under Stratton's stewardship, King's College was a religious institution closely aligned with the Church of England and the British colonial elite, known as the Family Compact. Reformist politicians who opposed the clergy's control over colonial institutions and thought to have the college secularized. In 1849, after a lengthy and heated debate, the newly elected responsible government for the provinces of Canada voted to rename King's College as the University of Toronto and severed the school's ties with the church. Having anticipated this decision, the enraged Strassman had resigned a year earlier to open Trinity College as a private Anglican seminary. University College was created with a non-denominational teaching branch of the University of Toronto, and during the American Civil War, the threat of the Union blockade on British North America prompted the creation of the University Rifle Corps, which saw battles in the Fenian raids, not American Civil War related, on the Niger border in 1866. I'm a little blurry at this point.
We can trade
we can
if you
trade.
Want.
The corps, my contacts are just dry. The corps was a part of the reserve militia led by Professor Henry Cross. And established in 1878, the School of Practical Science was the precursor to the Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering, which was nicknamed School since it was its earliest days. While the Faculty of Medicine opened in 1843, the medicinal teaching was conducted by property of schools from 1853 to 1887, when faculty absorbed the Toronto School of Medicine. Meanwhile, the university continued to set examinations and confer medical degrees, and the university opened the Faculty of Law in 1887, followed by the Faculty of Dentistry in 1888, and the Royal College of Dental Surgeons became an affiliate. Women were first admitted to this university in 1884. After a devastating fire in 1890, it gutted the interior of the university college and destroyed 33,000 volumes from the library. But the university restored the building and replenished its library within 2 years. Over the next two decades, the collegiate system took shape, and the university arranged for the federation of several ecclesiastic colleges, including Saxon's Trinity College in 1904. University operated the Royal Conservatory of Music from 1896 to 1991, and the Royal Ontario Museum from 1912 to 1968. Both retained close ties to the university as independent institutions. The University of Toronto Press was founded in 1901 and Canada's first academic publishing house. The Faculty of Forestry founded in 1907. Was Canada's first university faculty devoted to forest services. And in 1910, the Faculty of Education opened its laboratory school, the University of Toronto School. All right, time to switch.
Tales of the Supernatural don't faze the University of Toronto. In fact, the school embraces the lore, giving haunted tours of the campus. Multiple specters are rumored to linger on campus grounds, but perhaps the creepiest story of all is that of Russian stonemason Ivan Reznikov. University of Toronto magazine recounts the tale of the builder who was working on the University College building in 1856. The project's foreman, Paul Diablos, played a joke by carving one of the building's gargoyles in Reznikov's likeness. One night, Reznikov returned to the site to alter a gargoyle in Diablo's image, but he vanished. A student journalist quoted by the University of Toronto magazine reported that in 1889, Reznikov's ghost came back to visit one of the university students in the form of a mysterious long-haired figure. The figure explains that while he had been carving the gargoyle, he spotted Diablos with his fiancée, Susan. Reznikov tried to attack Diablos with an axe, missing the man and hitting a door instead. Diablos retaliated by stabbing the Russian with a knife, killing him and hiding the body in a ventilation shaft. The University of Toronto magazine says the mark from the axe can still be seen in University College's southwest corner, and workers later found the skeleton of a man wearing a belt buckle with a stonemason's emblem in a ventilation shaft. To this day, it is said that his ghost roams University College. Other buildings within the 191-year-old campus that are reportedly haunted included the Hart House Theater, the Laidlaw Library, the Christie Mansion, Massey College, and the Wahlberg Building. Students, professors, and even security staff would hear banging from empty rooms, objects mysteriously moving, and specters that suddenly vanish in the thin air. That, our friends, our dear friends, is our last story for this evening.
Well, not the last of the haunted universities and colleges. We already have a half a script.
Yes, so we have a lot more haunted colleges and universities coming, but that's not going to be our next episode.
No, next episode we're actually going to go up to Maine, and we're going to go to Mount Desert Island. Most of you probably know this as Acadia National Park. It does cover most of the island, but it does
also have Bar Harbor there.
Bar Harbor and a couple other smaller towns in the area surrounding the national park as well.
So
we're going to hop up there because
Bahada.
And go enjoy some blueberries and lobster.
Oh, blueberry pie.
Blueberry moon pie.
Oh, moon pies. Just moon pies in general.
Hi.
Blueberry pie and lobster rolls. Oh. Oh, yeah.
We need to get back there.
No.
Not this next year.
Not this time. Now, this time we're going to go on vacation in a couple months, and we're heading south.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Yeah, but we'll fill you all in on that on another occasion, because that we're actually going to go ahead and theme an entire one of these storytelling sessions around that. So we'll get back to that sometime.
So until then, we hope you guys enjoyed. If you want to catch us live somewhere, we are going to be at Haunted Nights at Henricus.
That's
October 2nd.
October 2nd. I think there's still some tickets available for that, and we're not going to be the only ones there. Our friends from RVA Paranormal are going to be there.
Saturday the 3rd, Transcend Paranormal will be there. The Tennessee Race Chasers are the guest investigators.
A couple of them are.
Yeah.
So you can meet a couple of paranormal investigators from some of our favorite TV shows.
Yep. We're going to be at Fleetwood Paracon on the 25th of September as vendors. So you'll be able to see us there. We are not participating in the investigation that night, but that's because I have to work the next morning.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, we wish we could stick around, but we're going to go up there and have a day of fun with our friends. It's amazing that that's less than 2 weeks out. And
I hear rumors of possible T-Rex races between the different paranormal groups.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Somebody has issued a challenge, and a couple of them have picked it up. So I'm waiting to see if we're going to T-Rex races.
I missed that part of the conversation. But that's going to be fun. We're going to be keeping busy. So actually, by the time we talk to y'all again, we'll have been there and back. Who knows? If you decide to drive on up to Fleetwood, it's about an hour and a half from Richmond here. Yeah,
it's at Brandy Station.
Yep.
And then in November, commute.
We're going to be joining Haunted Nights.
So now you're seeing why we call her Murder Boffin. Okay, you're going back in your calendar.
Yep, all right. we're going to be going as guests for an investigation of the USS Wisconsin down in Norfolk, and that's a Haunted Nights event as well. She got good, huh?
Yeah, no blood, though.
Oh, okay.
I think, maybe. I don't know. No, that's bleeding.
Oh, dear.
She drew blood.
Glenn's going to be at the Bellagrove Plantation Halloween Bash.
Awesome.
as much as I don't think we'll be able to make that one.
No, we have to
work on it. I think everybody
will be able to. 3 or maybe 4. 3 right now.
It's going to be four. Probably be 4. Either way, yeah. And yes, the T-Rex safety races are going to be fun. So, hey, we're going to be out and about. Hope that you can come see us. And, hey, if you can't come see us on those special occasions, you can always join us for a tour.
Yeah.
We've still got tours operating every weekend. When we're not going to be around giving the tours, our
guys will be having fun leading.
Our amazing guys will be taking care of things. So, and we have plenty of going on. Is the prime spooky season is approaching, even though it's always spooky season for us.
Yeah.
But prime spooky season is right around the corner. So, anyways, with that, I'll stop rambling.
And we will see you all in 2 weeks.
Yeah, thanks again for joining us, y'all. And, have a good one. I'll talk to y'all soon.
Bye.
I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man dampen his feet. This is a place where eternally fire is applied to the body.